You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a program in Eau Claire that will put free books on public buses.
First, the abortion rate in the United States is now at a historic low, at least since the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling that made abortion legal nationwide in 1973. That's according to a recent study, and it's got both sides of the abortion debate talking.
While both sides may welcome fewer abortions as good news, there's still the big question of why the rate is down. And while the study didn't directly investigate reasons behind the decline, it did identify some trends that may help put things into context.
Jenna German joins us now. She's a research associate at the Guttmacher Institute, which specializes in sexual and reproductive health and policy. The Institute supports legalized abortion and has tracked the country's abortion rate since 1973 by conducting a census every few years of all known abortion providers. Jenna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So as we said in the introduction there, abortion rates in the United States, according to your research, have dropped to a historic low. What kinds of numbers are you seeing?
That's right. Abortion has dropped to a historic low. This is the first time that abortions have dropped below a million. So in 2014, there were an estimated 926,000 abortions that were performed, and this is 12% fewer than in 2011. And so not just the abortion incidence, but also the abortion rate and the total number of clinics providing abortions also have dropped since 2011.
How long have you been seeing this trend?
So this is a continuation of a trend that's been going on for many years, and abortion is now at its lowest level since before 1973, when abortion was legalized nationwide through Roe v. Wade.
Now, your study didn't look into the reasons behind the declining abortion rate, but can you tell us some of the factors that seem like they could have contributed to this trend?
Right. So as you mentioned, this was a descriptive study, so we didn't directly examine the reasons behind the decline. But the best available evidence points to two main factors that were at work here. And first, we think that improvements in contraceptive use contributed to the decline in abortion. There's evidence that more women started using highly effective contraceptive methods, such as the IUD, during this time. And improved contraceptive use, of course, leads to fewer unattended pregnancies, thereby decreasing the need for abortion. And this is a continuation of a trend that has been going on for several years, so there's some good evidence there. And then the second factor behind the the second factor was the increase in the abortion restrictions. So between 2011 and 2014, which was the time period for the study, 231 state abortion restrictions were enacted. So state restrictions and trap laws in particular, which are the targeted regulation of abortion providers, may force clinics to close and therefore might prevent women from accessing the abortion services that they need.
Did you see a correlation between states that had laws like this and states that saw some of the bigger decreases in abortion rates?
You know, there were some, but it's definitely not a straightforward story. So, for example, let's say abortion restrictions, if that was the only thing behind the decline, then you would expect to see a decline in abortion only in those states that were most restrictive around abortion. But in fact, that's not what we saw. Abortion declined in almost every single state, even in those that we would consider to be supportive of abortion rights.
In those states that did have some of these more restrictive laws that you're talking about, was there any evidence maybe that women were having trouble finding a provider and you were seeing maybe an increase in later-term abortions?
Well, that's not something that this study looked at, but certainly there is other evidence out there that suggests that when women have a hard time accessing the services that they need, it does push them into later gestations.
You mentioned contraception as an issue, and the Affordable Care Act requires coverage on a wide variety of contraception methods. Do you think that has played a significant role, the Affordable Care Act, in possibly bringing down these numbers?
Well, it's hard to say if the Affordable Care Act specifically had an impact on the abortion and the abortion rate, because, again, as I mentioned, this study was from 2014, and the contraceptive coverage guarantee, I believe, didn't go into effect until 2013, and so You know, it's possible that a lot of women really didn't get coverage until 2014. So this study kind of covered the tail end of that. So it's not necessarily clear if that is showing up in these data. However, since we do know that the ACA really did facilitate access to contraception, and since we do know that it is a pretty major factor in preventing unintended pregnancies and therefore abortion, it is a very important thing, an important factor at play in terms of abortion.
We're talking with Jenna German right now, research associate at the Guttmacher Institute. She specializes in sexual and reproductive health and policy, and she's with us to talk about the declining abortion rate in the United States. And Jenna, another aspect looked at here was medication abortions. Can you tell us about what you saw there?
Yes. So even though the total number of abortions has declined since 2011, the proportion of abortions that were medication abortion actually went up from 24% of all abortions in 2011 to 31% in 2014. So again, even though the total number of abortions went down, the proportion that were medication versus surgical went up.
And people may be wondering, if they're not familiar, what a medication abortion is. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So medication abortion is just another option in terms of the type of procedure that patients are able to get. And medication abortion, according to the best of practices and the FDA guidelines, can go up to 10 weeks of gestation. So it is a type of procedure that women can access earlier in their pregnancies when abortion is safest and most affordable. So to have this option available for women is very important so that it can facilitate access to abortions when women want them in a timely manner.
So the overall abortion rate went down, but these medication abortions, the rate there rose. Do you have any thinking about why that is?
The study didn't really look into the exact factors behind that, but it could just have to do with the type of services that women want to access and what's available to them.
And in terms of a big picture takeaways from your study, what else did you find?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, abortion is down across the board. So the abortion incidence, which is the total number of abortion, the abortion rate, and again, abortion clinics, all went down. And because this is a continuation of a trend that we've been seeing, you know, what it points to really is how important access to contraception and abortion services and just the full range of reproductive health services are for women. You know, women really need to be able to access the health care that they need in order to be able to time and space their families and take care of their families to the best of their ability.
Now, looking again at states that may have had more restriction to abortion services, maybe where clinics closed down, do you think that that could have played a role here?
It certainly could have played a role. As I mentioned, there were many state-level abortion restrictions that went into place since 2011, which was the time period for this study. And especially in those states where those restrictions had the effect of closing clinics, that might impact whether women are able to access those services at all.
Are you expecting this trend, this downward trend, to continue in the next 2 or 3 years?
It's hard to say, of course, since I don't have a crystal ball. But since this has been the trend for a good number of years now, it's reasonable to expect that it would continue. But, of course, that would depend on some pretty important factors, and I think the biggest one being women's access to contraceptive services and contraceptive methods that they want. So assuming that women continue to be able to access affordable and effective contraceptive methods, then yeah, I think that we would expect to see this.
Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jenna German is a research associate at the Guttmacher Institute, which specializes in sexual and reproductive health and policy. She joined us to talk about the declining abortion rate in the United States. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a program in Eau Claire that will put free books on public buses.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Wisconsin winters are known for being cold and harsh. But John Goethe reminds us of the 19th century settlers who toughed it out on the edge of the world.
Wisconsin winters can seem endless, even if we were born here, even if the season is relatively mild. By January, we forget that the air was ever warm, that the world outside our windows was ever green. The fact is that we've got it easy. Imagine, if you can, what winter was like for Milwaukee's pioneers. Lake Michigan was their major lifeline to the outside world. When ice brought shipping to a halt every November, Milwaukee was beyond the reach of civilization until the following April. News was scarce, mail service was painfully slow, and the settlers had only each other to stare at for the next 4 or 5 months. The long freeze required as much preparation as a polar expedition. In 1836, Albert Fowler listed the provisions he had put aside before the last ship left in November. 4 barrels of flour, 100 pounds of butter, a barrel of crackers, a barrel of beef, and a large supply of potatoes, carrots, and other vegetables. A monotonous diet was not the only drawback of a frontier winter. Most of the early settlers were young men on the make, and months of enforced idleness must have been maddening. There were precious few distractions of any kind. No smartphones, no computers, not even a public library. It was probably a pioneer who coined the term cabin fever. There were compensations. Some settlers kept their hands in one of the euchre games always in progress at local hotels. Some used the time to dig into the latest James Fenimore Cooper novel. Despite the presence of a strong temperance faction, most drank. Pioneer historian James Buck counted more than 100 rum holes in frontier Milwaukee, each offering its own brand of warmth and dissipation. Hardier souls spent much of the season on the ice. Most of Milwaukee's present downtown was a marsh, and it provided excellent ice skating. Benjamin Miller, an 1839 arrival, recalled the central wetlands as a winter wonderland. I had put on my skates at the corner of Wisconsin and Van Buren Streets, Miller recalled in 1898, and skated from there south to the old harbor mouth. That's a distance of nearly 2 miles. A pair of New Yorkers, Elisha and Benjamin Edgerton, favored indoor entertainment. In 1836, despite a critical shortage of women, they paid a Chicago fiddler named Joe Davlin $150 to play a series of winter cotillion parties. Davlin liked Milwaukee so much that he settled there, and Elisha Edgerton pronounced the cotillions a great success. Navigation never resumed before the end of March, and the ice sometimes lasted into early May. By that time, Milwaukeeans must have felt as isolated as astronauts on the International Space Station. They were ready for new faces, new goods, newer news. The first ship of the season brought all that and more. It meant the resumption of life. We have largely conquered the season. Moving from home to car to work or school, we travel from one artificial hothouse to another. But we, too, feel the ancient hunger for real warmth and real light in the depths of winter. Take heart. The days lengthen.
John Goethe is an award-winning historian and author. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Okay, Rob, let's say you're riding the bus to work and you reach in your backpack only to realize you forgot the book you've been reading. Wouldn't it be great if you had some kind of backup option?
It would be, and our next guest might be able to help. She's here to tell us about an effort to provide free books on public transit buses in Eau Claire. Shelley Collins-Furbringer is the Youth Services Manager for the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. Shelley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this Books on Buses program. How would this work?
Well, we're still in the planning stages, but the idea actually came from a city council member who was talking to our library director, who was relatively new, and she thought this would be a great program to start up in Eau Claire. So the idea is just what it sounds like. We would put a small rack on all 22 of the city's public transit buses, and they would be filled with books that we provide from the library that have either been withdrawn from our collection or have been donated for a book sale or that type of thing. And we would just keep the supply ready, and it would be available for all ages.
And it sounds like the riders who pick up a book, they get to keep it?
Exactly. We saw another library. We've been doing some searching around, and there are libraries across the United States that do this, not a ton of them. But the idea is really take it, read it, share it. So if you want to just read it on the bus and return it to the rack, you can. If it's a novel and you think, wow, I'd like to continue reading this, you've got as long as you want. If it's great, you can share it with other friends, or you can take it back to the bus, or you can keep it for your collection.
Yeah, when we first heard about this, we were talking about how would that work, checking out a book on the library, would you have to return it to the same bus? This is actually more like the little free libraries
exactly.
that people have out around towns.
Exactly. That is really the idea here. These are all books. You don't have to check them out. They're yours to keep if you want them for as long as you want. So that's the beauty of it.
And what do you hope gets done by putting books in a different place than readers might normally find them?
Well, one of our strategic goals is to reach out into the community. And so outreach has become a big part of our plan for the next 5 years. And we started last summer with a book bike. And that's we really do take a little library of library materials out into the community. We pull it with a bike, and we do check those out. And I think that this is not an extension of that, but it's another way to get out into the community, to surprise people. And I think that we just want people to see the library in a new light.
Yeah, full disclosure, I'm married to a librarian who's big on this idea of community engagement. And the idea
yeah.
is the library doesn't stop at the front door of the library. It's
exactly.
out there in the community more, right?
And as much we try every day to develop programming and services to get people in the doors, and I think we do a great job. But the fact is, there will always be some people who don't come to the library, and that's okay. Really, one of my goals is, especially for children, is to get books into their hands. There are a lot of kids, here in Eau Claire and across the state and the nation that don't have a single book that they own that is theirs. So for our summer library program, we've been giving, instead of trinkets for prizes, we've been giving a book, a forever book, for them to keep. And it's really exciting. And so I guess I see this program as an extension of that.
Shelley, are you worried at all that people will grab a book, get so engrossed in it that they miss their stops and end up miles from home? This has actually happened to me. So I speak from experience. There's a hazard here.
Well, I would probably be one of those people. I don't even know how to answer that question. Hopefully.
Getting lost in a book is never really bad, right?
Exactly.
Well, Shelley, you mentioned getting books in kids' hands. You're the youth services manager there in Eau Claire. Talk about the importance of getting books in kids' hands and getting them reading or read to, depending on the age. How important is that?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of benefits, but especially in that 0 to 5, when their little brains are still developing, it's so important for us to be reading to kids, and a lot of parents don't connect with that idea, especially with infants, because they think, well, they don't understand the book anyway. But there's all sorts of research out there that explains why it's important. And, for adults, too, we want them to read. It can reduce stress. It can feed your imagination. Reading to your child can create a bond between the two of you. When I was talking with one of the transit folks, I said, I would imagine that on the bus every once in a while, you've got a little kid who's having a meltdown. I know I see it in here. And a lot of times they're having a meltdown in here because they don't want to leave, which I think is great, but the parent doesn't. But, you know, how great for that parent to be able to pull out a book that's got a character that that kid recognizes and think, oh, you know, and get that, that's a great experience. So maybe riding the bus isn't a great experience always for that kid, but if they know that they can look forward to getting a new book each time, that may make going to the grocery store a little bit more palatable.
So with the little free libraries we were talking about, the idea is that people put books that they love there for someone else to take. Yes. How are you curating the books that go onto the buses? Who's picking them?
Well, right now, and again, and this is just in the works, but right now what we're doing is I have asked each of the selectors in our library who select books for both children, teen, and adults. We have a system in place where we've just put a gold slip on them, and that means that that book needs to be evaluated. So if they say, wow, this book is in really great shape, maybe it was long overdue, but it's still in great shape, but we've already purchased another copy, then it gets chosen to go to the book bin for the buses. And then there are two of us in youth services who will be evaluating all of the books. And then we are going to be working closely with transit to get feedback from the drivers because they will be helping us stock the bins on the buses. And, you know, there may be some routes that have a lot of college students and they aren't really interested in picture books, or they may, you know, different segments of the population on different routes. So we're really looking to get feedback from the drivers as to what they want us to stock. So mostly the two of us will be curating that collection.
And briefly, Shelley, this is in the works. Do you have a timeline when this is going to hit the road?
Well, we still have a lot to do. One of our goals is to have a community partnership, possibly with a business in town who will help us build the racks that will go on the buses. But our hope really is that this is up and running by summer.
Terrific. Shelley, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Shelley Collins-Furbringer. She's the Youth Services Manager for the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. And we've been talking about a program that's going to put free books on public buses there.
Coming up, our guest tells us why he hears overtones of fascism in Donald Trump's American First rhetoric. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on this week's edition of Snap Judgment.
First, for quite a while before his inauguration day, critics of Donald Trump have accused him of exhibiting some characteristics of fascism. Fascism, as we know it, began with Benito Mussolini in Italy in 1922. Many historians agree it includes traits of hyper-nationalism, nostalgia for a long-gone golden age, an obsession with masculinity, and a strong, uncompromising leader.
For our next guest and other critics, Donald Trump's inauguration speech had overtones of fascism, particularly in his use of America First language.
You can find a couple pieces about this question, including one by our guest, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Matt Rothschild is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Matt, I want to start by listening to a bit of the America First section of Donald Trump's Inauguration Day speech.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America First. America First. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
Yeah.
Protection will lead to great prosperity and strength. I will fight for you with every breath in my body, and I will never, ever let you down.
Kamit, what did you hear in that section of the speech that got at a lot of that America First language that you write about?
Well, he loves the expression America First. He used it during the campaign. Actually, he was criticized for using it during the campaign by the Anti-Defamation League, which is a group of Jewish Americans who look out for signs of anti-Semitism in the country. He was asked in April not to use it. He kept using it. And he used it there. I mean, it corresponds with a group in the late 1930s in the United States, led most notoriously by Charles Lindbergh, who uttered some very anti-Semitic comments at that time under the banner of America First. And so for a long time, it's been known as an anti-Semitic trope, including, you know, David Duke, after he read the or heard the inauguration speech, congratulated Trump for using his slogan, America First. So I think that should worry people, if not horrify people in this country. And then you go to whitehouse.gov and he's got America First right there at the top of his issues. America First energy policy, America First foreign policy. I mean, the guy loves it.
History knowledge in the United States can be pretty shallow, and 1930s by some measures is a long time ago. I mean, are you suggesting that Donald Trump deliberately called back to this, or that he is lighting on the same phrase and the same ideas in a later time?
Well, I mean, since the Anti-Defamation League pointed it out to him, it shouldn't have been news to him. If he were literate, and we don't know that he's literate or not, he should have known about it. Philip Roth wrote a book about fascists in the United States in the 1930s called The Plot Against America, which I highly recommend to any of your listeners. In fact, in the appendix to that book are verbatim speeches that Charles Lindbergh made under the banner of America First, and you can see the flagrant anti-Semitism right there for yourselves.
You also heard a reference to Mussolini, you said, the father of fascism, in a way, in a quote from the speech where Trump referenced this being a time of action and a reference to being a man of action, according to Mussolini.
Yeah, I mean, fascism, especially Mussolini's version, was all about action. In fact, the root, I think, of the word fascism has something to do about action or making something. And so Mussolini loved to call himself a man of action, and in the speech came the line with a kind of a weird construction, now arrives the hour of action. But certainly he views himself as a man of action. I mean, that's you know, he's always puffing and bragging and strutting across the stage and criticized people, including John Lewis, of all people, for not being a man of action, for being all talk. John Lewis, one of the leaders of the civil rights movement, who had his head smashed on that bridge, on that march to Selma.
Criticisms of John Lewis aside, Washington has been in gridlock for a long time. Approval ratings of Congress are at record lows. Doesn't the American public want action?
They want action, but do they want the man of action? Do they want the great man? And this came out at his speech at the Republican convention. I'm the only person who can fix the system. I alone can fix the system. And if you contrast that with what Bernie Sanders was saying, for instance, and they had some things in common with their criticism of trade, for instance, Bernie Sanders said, if I get elected, I can't do anything without your help. And by you, I mean you and millions of other people who need to mobilize in the streets and take on the establishment in Washington. What does Trump say? All you need to do is elect me and I'll take them all on because I'm the smartest guy you ever saw.
I want to talk about another part of the speech that you write about, and this is a section about loyalty.
The bedrock of our politics will be a total allegiance to the United States of America. And through our loyalty to our country, we will rediscover our loyalty to each other. When you open your heart to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice.
And Matt, what bothers you about that quote, specifically, I think, the beginning?
Yeah, the ending didn't bother me, but this beginning, first of all, a total allegiance to the United States of America. the total is bothersome. I mean, I can see, you know, we, kids are still pledging allegiance to the flag, but the idea that you have total allegiance to your country, regardless of what your country is doing to you, and then that other sentence is just a peculiar sentence.
The one that follows?
Yeah, through our loyalty to our country, we will discover our loyalty to each other. Well, I would assert that we have loyalty to each other because we love our neighbors as our friends, or we have loyalty to each other because we love our spouses or our family members, or we have loyalty to our friends and colleagues because we admire what they're doing in the world, rather than we need to get to their patriotism before we can be loyal to them. I mean, that's just odd to me. But the emphasis on loyalty, the emphasis on total allegiance, total. I mean, this is a guy, you know, some of us think he's totalitarian. And then for him to use a word like total allegiance really sends a bad echo through our ears.
We're talking with Math Rothschild right now. He's telling us why he sees overtones of fascism in Donald Trump's America First rhetoric. Matt's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And Matt, there's been a lot written about this, and some people feel that a fascist is the wrong label, overtone or no, and that there's some key tenets of fascism that don't really apply here, and that this is not the right thing to say. Sherry Berman, for instance, in Vox says that. For instance, she says fascists typically have a distrust of capitalism, and Donald Trump embraces it. How do you answer that?
Well, fascists also embrace capitalism. Hitler embraced capitalism. I mean, he had the Volkswagen company, he had the Krupp company, he had the Ford Motor Company working for him. Mussolini was famous for his alliance between corporatism and the state as a part of his definition or alleged definition of fascism. Look, this guy has a cult of personality, too, which is part of fascism. I mean, he wants so much this adoration. He has this narcissism that is almost a five-year-old childishness. And there are other things that suggest that he's kind of fascist. You know, I've resisted using the F word in public for many, many years, Veronica, because I thought the F word was overblown and not accurate and distorts what happened during World War II. I'm a Jewish American. I don't look at Nazi analogies very comfortably. But this certainly is the closest we've had to a fascist in the Oval Office ever. I think that is certainly a safe thing to say. I mean, he does cultivate a mass base. That's different than your run-of-the-mill authoritarian, for instance. He's not, you know, Pinochet, because he's got this mass base, which is something that Mussolini did. Everything he's been doing since inauguration has been playing to that mass base. And, he's hyper-militarist. He's got more generals in the White House, you know, than, you know, Ulysses S. Grant, practically. He scapegoats minorities. That's a trademark of a fascist, Mexicans and Muslims and refugees from day one, and including today with his new order on visas for refugees and on, you know, throwing people out of the country who aren't here with documents. So, I mean, he's still at it. And talking about the wall, too. So he's still playing on racism, and that is one of the signatures of a fascist.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got a first caller here from John at 800-642-1234. And John is with us from Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hey, Matt. Hey, Veronica. I love the show. I disagree with your guest. Matt, I think you need to coexist, relax, and chill out. The guy's been in office for, 4 days? And everyone's already attacking him as a narcissist. He had the fewest mentions of I in an inaugural speech in history. Mr. Obama was the biggest narcissist we ever saw. And there's nothing close to fascism here. America First, you know, words change, Matt. Gay meant carefree and having fun in 1941. And now it means something regarding homosexuality. So, you know, words change. And everyone's trying to link this word to a time in history that's long gone by. And Trump's never demonstrated any anti-Semitic intent, whatever. So it's baseless, and you're reaching.
John, thanks for the call. Matt, what do you say?
Well, I wish I could have the comfort that John has. I just don't have it. I thought one of Trump's late ads was anti-Semitic. He talked about international bankers. He talked about the Fed. He showed pictures of Janet Yellen and George Soros and Lloyd Blankfein, who are identifiable Jewish people in the finance sector. Another thing that we haven't talked about yet, Veronica, is his flagrant lying. I mean, look what's happened since the inauguration. He has two just gigantic lies. One is his obsession with the size of the crowd at his inauguration being as big as Obama's. And the second was, you know, that there are millions of people who committed voting fraud. I mean, and there's no evidence for either of those. In fact, there's contrary evidence. And so for people who are worried about authoritarianism or fascism, let me read to you two quotes. One is from George Orwell. "The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and your ears. It was their final, most essential command." And here's Henry Wallace, vice president under Truman, who ran for president in 1948 in the Progressive Party. "The American fascists are most easily recognized by their deliberate perversion of truth and of fact." I mean, we can't have more a deliberate perversion than what we've seen here over the last few days, and that is really alarming.
Matt Rothschild is with us right now in studio, and he's telling us why he hears and sees overtones of fascism in Donald Trump's America First rhetoric. And Matt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you share our guest fears or think they're overblown? Do you think it's hyperbole to use the F word, fascism, overtones of fascism, or do you think there's a genuine concern? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And Matt Rothschild is here with us. He's telling us why he hears overtones of fascism in Donald Trump's America First language. Matt's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Do you agree with our guest about hearing overtones of fascism in some of Donald Trump's rhetoric or policy choices? Or do you think that label is overblown, maybe inaccurate? Call 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go back to our callers now. We've got Eric joining us next in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of different people, and this right wing, like referring back to your caller, the people that are just ignoring the facts, whether it be the rate increases of Obamacare. The rate increases were because of the insurance company raised the rates. They will argue that point till their death. They ignore history. They ignore the facts. These actions demonstrated, or by Donald Trump, they're just, how do you can't argue against them if you look at the facts and what he says, but yet they are dug in, and they're you will not change their mind. It's impossible.
Eric, thanks a lot for calling, and I get where you're going with that. Eric, starting off there, looking at the disagreement on something basic, which is a fact, what is true, what is demonstrable. What do you think about that aspect, Matt?
Well, we saw over the weekend this ludicrousness of Kellyanne Conway, Trump's mouthpiece, talking about alternative facts, and his press secretary talking about, you know, we can contest the facts, and or have our own set of facts that are, you know, kind of contrary. And that's what I mean about the flagrant lying that's going on. But what I would disagree with Eric on is there are some people who don't, for instance, agree with me and probably don't agree with Eric, who are susceptible to conversation. I'm a believer still. I'm a man of the I still believe in the Age of Enlightenment. Maybe I'm a dinosaur. But I think, you know, we still can have conversation with people. We actually have to have conversation with people who don't agree with us. It's really what politics is all about. And if we're going to give up on it, then we're just going to return to our camps. And there's no possible way for having a rational conversation in this country or to be able able to persuade people at the level of values even. So I don't give up on conversation and friendly argument. I mean, not everyone who voted for Trump is flying a Nazi flag, though I saw a Nazi flag being flown out of a home in Oshkosh, at least on Facebook, which is a little disturbing. But, you know, there are people who I know who voted for Trump who are not bad people and who are willing to have a discussion.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to move next to Nathan in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I did want to thank your guests for knowing a little bit of history in that even if I don't go all the way with calling Trump a fascist, some of the things he's done are disturbing. And fascism, if you do go back in history, is both an external and an internal enemy of democracy in that democratic governments were internally overthrown by fascists. Hitler had a party that won an election. After that, they decided they didn't need elections after all, but they did get through one. There is some history in there, and certainly with major companies being willing to cut contracts with fascist leaders, that is actually 100% factually true.
Nathan, thank you for the call and the thoughts. Matt, what are your thoughts there?
Well, Nathan reminds me that democracies can die fast. I mean, look at Germany. Germany was the height of Western civilization, the height of philosophy, the height of literature, the height of music, the height of art, and it was gone. And yes, Hitler came to power through an election. Chile had a democracy for 100 years and it died in a night. We sometimes think that our system of checks and balances is just so great that we can ride out any wave, even this big wave that we're feeling the sea salt from. But look at what really worries me is what happens if the United States is attacked again and nothing even of the size of 9/11. How would this man who is so ill-suited temperamentally to be president react? He could blow up the world in the time it takes us to fry an egg. He could rip up the Constitution. You may think I'm, again, engaging in a hyperbole, but General Tommy Frank, who led the war against Iraq, said if we're attacked again, this time by terrorists, maybe with weapons of mass destruction, we're going to have to declare martial law. One of Rice's deputies at the National Security Council, general, said the same thing. And so when the generals are talking out loud about the possibility of martial law, you can bet that their subordinates have plans on the shelf for martial law. And then what would Trump have to do? Just bring him down and dust him off.
So looking again at the piece, you're seeing overtones of fascism, it sounds like, in the policy and the words of Donald Trump. Why does it matter to slap a label on this to say this is fascism? Other people choose to label it as populism. They don't see fascism. They see maybe a right-wing populist. But why should we spend time on this instead of just looking at what's happening in the White House?
Because we need to protect our democracy. We need to rally, and that's why I was so exhilarated by the rally in Madison of 75,000 to 100,000 people, and exhilarated by the rally in Washington where my wife went and participated in. That's what we need now. We need people to protest. We need people to express their discomfort at the very least, or horror at the outside at what some of the things that Trump is doing. There was a beautiful little bit of theater that happened in Washington, D.C. today where Greenpeace put up a sign that said resist about a block behind the White House. So if you took a picture of the White House, there was a big banner that said resist behind it. And that's kind of clever. And we need to join organizations that are under assault, like Planned Parenthood or ACLU or Voices de la Frontera, and just find ways that we can resist and do it with friends and have fun doing it, because I think this is a very dangerous time. The reason I use the F word is because I want to underscore exactly how dangerous it is.
And going forward, what are you going to be looking for in policy? It sounds like you're looking at the language of the Trump administration and informing how you want to react, how you want to think about this, how you want to engage what's happening. What are you looking for next? And just quick answer,
well,
please.
You know, assaults on liberalism is a trademark of a fascist. Assaults on the media, we're already seeing that. You know, Trump says he's got a running war with the media now, and he wants all the information to come from him as opposed to the media. I think those are all alarming signs. Will some Republicans actually have the backbone to stand up to him? Will Democrats? Those are the questions in my mind.
And we leave it there. Matt, thank you so much for coming into the studio and talking today.
My pleasure.
That was Matt Rothschild. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And he joined us to talk about why he hears echoes of fascism in Donald Trump's rhetoric. And we have a couple of pieces up there, different perspectives on the Central Time Facebook page. You can check those out and see what you think. Let us know. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.